But when I lived in Dublin as an undergraduate, it was my first time really experiencing a big city. You know, and Dublin is actually relatively a tiny city in global terms. But for me, it was this huge cosmopolitan place.
Hello and welcome to The Family of Things, a podcast of life and how we choose to live it. I'm Helen Shaw, and my guest today is American writer and academic Lauren Arrington, who has made Ireland her home and taken its cultural contemporary history as her life's work. Lauren is professor of English literature at Maynooth University and director of the Yeats Summer School in Sligo. She's previously written a landmark biography of Constance Markievicz and her husband, Casimir, and her new work, The Poets of Rapello, hinges on the dark undertones of W.B. Yeats's close friendship with the American poet Ezra Pound in the shadow of Mussolini's fascism. Hi, Lauren. So I think you're in tropical Florida, back home at the moment with your family. How are you?
We're great. Yeah, we've just survived Tropical Storm Elsa, which was nothing by Florida standards. We get thunderstorms worse than that. So that's just passed over yesterday, and now it's beautiful and sunny, and it's such a gift to be here after, you know, the year and a half that we've all been through with COVID and lockdown and severely restricted travel. So I just feel very lucky.
And Lauren, I know you lost your dad earlier in the year, so I think you were saying February. So my sincere condolences with that. And obviously that's also part of why you're back home for the whole summer.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I'm an only surviving child. I have an older brother who passed away when I was 11.
So I'm so sorry.
Thank you. Yes. I feel a lot of responsibility towards my mother. So just to be able to be here and have this long chunk of time to kind of spend with her, and also to spend with the memory of my dad in the place that he lived for his whole life, is extraordinary.
So Florida is where you grew up and where they lived for most of their life?
Absolutely. So I think my father's family has been in this part of Florida for at least 5 generations. And they're not a family that was like historically wealthy, so had records to keep. So no one really knows where we came from beyond that kind of surviving family memory. I asked my dad once where we were from before we were from Florida, and he said Georgia. So I've been in the South for a very long time.
And in many ways, when we think of Florida, we think of the coast and we think of all of the resorts, and we kind of have a stereotype when we're not there, particularly say in Ireland, about it. But it's such a big region as well. I mean, there's that sense also of Hemingway and the exoticness of writing from parts of Florida as well. So where's your Florida and what's it like?
So I grew up and am in now the Big Bend area of Florida. So kind of north central Florida. I grew up on about 30 acres of farmland with my grandmother on a big chunk of land across the road, and my uncle on another big chunk of land down the road, and cousins kind of scattered in the surrounding area. So kind of very Irish. This area was homesteaded by my great-grandfather when kind of Florida is being settled in the 19th century. And then it was parceled up through the generations. So the house I'm in now was built on land that was given to my aunt, which then passed to my father just shortly before my aunt passed away. So it's just a place with a long agrarian memory, but not really an historical memory. You know, rural places often exist outside of time in a way. And that was something that I felt very profoundly when I was growing up. It was really easy to imagine, you know, as kids do, that they're kind of living in a different century, and it was kind of very romantic imagination, which has obviously been dispelled as I've educated myself as an adult and what settlement, you know, what homesteading really means in terms of displacement. So we're about 40 miles from the Gulf of Mexico. It's a fishing region. There are a few islands that kind of make their money off fishing. And so it's a very quiet place.
It sounds magical, steeped in stories and perhaps alligators. And Lauren, obviously, growing up in that kind of environment, as you say, sometimes as adults, we can see it differently. Did you always have a sense of being from the South and those stories of the South?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And it's something that I rebelled against, you know, as an older child and then a teenager, kind of a backward racist sensibility, not among my immediate family, but in kind of grandparents and more distant relations, and something that I really wanted to get away from because it seemed like there was no way to overcome it, you know, myself as a child and teenager. So I went away to college. I went to a small university in Tennessee, which doesn't sound very far, I think, if you're not from here, but it felt like a long way away at the time. Yeah, and then I felt like I had amazing support for the first 2 years of my undergraduate degree there. So I felt like I wanted to stretch my wings a little bit. And that's when I did a year abroad at Trinity. And then went back and finished college in the States and then had a year out and decided to go back to Ireland. And so that was my kind of introduction, really, which was very, in a way, kind of accidental to Ireland as a place.
Because you and I first met when I was doing a big radio series around the 100 years since 1913. And your book, your biography on Constance and Kazimir Markievicz was in process. And I remember asking you that, did you have connections to Ireland? What brought you to Ireland? Because in some ways, we're so used to the idea that so many Americans have Irish ancestry and roots, but that's not your story.
No, not at all. For me, it was purely a kind of in curiosity about Ireland as a place, a lot of accident, really very lucky accident that introduced me to Irish literature and history. And I had a very early fascination with the country's history because of the place. It probably sounds very funny to you, but when I lived in Dublin as an undergraduate, it was my first time really experiencing a big city. You know, and Dublin is actually relatively a tiny city in global terms. But for me, it was this huge cosmopolitan place, you know, and this was like in 2001. So, you know, not nearly as cosmopolitan as it is now. But that shift for me and kind of the access to culture, the access to books, the access to people who are thinking deep and complex thoughts about all sorts of, you know, things in the world. It excited me very kind of like a fundamental level. And so that was the beginning of my interest.
What year was that when you first came to Dublin?
So that was in 2001. I think I was there for the Euro changeover. We went from the punt to the Euro. And as a student, the sudden rise in inflation was horrific for me. I remember one week just basically eating carrots and carrot soup because everything suddenly became incredibly expensive. But I remember too, like nothing was open. You know, you couldn't do anything on Sunday. And when I kind of moved back then, as an adult working, I was like, what is this place? You know, there you can get out on the weekends. It's amazing.
And it's amazing how quickly things changed from that environment. It's changed a lot in a short period from 2000 onwards, even culturally, socially, the whole impact of the referenda on marriage equality and then the repeal of the Eighth Amendment. So you've probably had that sense of witnessing being a bystander as well as then becoming a resident part of the story of Ireland's change.
Absolutely. And as an outsider, you know, and as an outsider from a very small, stable place, like I say, that has existed in a way apart from major historical changes in the 20th century in the United States, I can understand too the resistance to that change. You know, not that I at all agree with it, but I understand how hard it is to kind of bring people along with that kind of rapid change. Because when you step back, it is an incredibly dynamic, incredibly short period of time that people are having to adjust to, you know, particularly if they've not been introduced to this kind of change and this democratic, frankly, ideas in other contexts, you know, if they've lived their lives in the same kind of place. So it can be hard to bring people along, I think.
And when you first came to Ireland and you began to study and read in that, was it always Yeats and the poetry that pulled you in? Or were you broadly reading, you know, across literature and Irish literature at that stage?
I was very broadly reading. I really enjoyed Gothic Irish writing as an undergraduate.
Bram Stoker,
Le Fanu, William Carleton, all that was absolutely fascinating. I also really enjoyed contemporary Irish writing, the kind of reading I was doing. So I remember enjoying particularly John Banville's Dr. Copernicus, for example.
I love that series of novels that he did with Kepler as well. It was an incredible series.
Yeah, absolutely. So I enjoyed that breadth of reading that the degrees gave me. And then I didn't know what I wanted to do after I did my master's degree. And I just mentioned to one of my lecturers, Helen O'Connell, who's now at Durham University, and she actually taught us the course on the Gothic at UCD, that I was maybe thinking about a PhD and like, what should I do? And she said, well, you should apply to Oxford. Why don't you apply to Oxford? And I thought, gosh, that never occurred to me. Okay. And like, just out of audacity and ignorance, I put in my application, and it was actually the only PhD program that I was accepted to. And so I moved from Dublin to England, never having been there before, you know, not having any awareness of what I was really embarking on, but arriving and absolutely feeling like I was in my element. I was surrounded by people who wanted to spend their lives reading and writing and thinking. And that was just such a breath of fresh air. It felt in a way like kind of a homecoming for me.
It's such a beautiful place, Oxford, and it just has that sense of a place apart in terms of the university itself. And was that in some ways a magical and exploratory period in your life at Oxford?
It was magical. It was also incredibly hard. So, you know, it was a homecoming intellectually, but it was also a huge jolt in terms of not being kind of the typical Oxford student, not being even the typical American student there, because I wasn't from a big city. I was not from a family of academics. You know, I wasn't trained in kind of codes of behavior and interaction. And so I had to learn those all really quickly.
I mean, what do you mean by codes of behavior? Because I suppose we understand the Ivy League, and, you know, you hadn't come through that route of Harvard or Stanford into Oxford, and it has that elitism about it. But can you share a sense of what was that culture clash when you went to Oxford?
I think one of them is self-presentation. So I'm talking about intellectually. Conversation, the way you present yourself as, quote, an intellectual. You know, there was this conversation around, you know, my work, and I found it incredibly grating and infuriating and tiring, the way that my colleagues automatically knew how to discuss their work as though, I don't know, they're discovering how to fuse an atom or something. And, you know, they were working on 20th century poetry. But I think I naturally had a lot of humility coming into that environment, again, because of my background. And so I could also see through those codes and had to learn kind of how to adopt them when it was necessary, but also to understand that this was just, in a way, just a big bluff, you know, and that you kind of had to bluff your way through. There's also a really interesting social code, it seems to me, in that you never say exactly what you think about something. There's this way of talking sideways about things, and that's not just an English thing either. I found it also in Ireland, this kind of, you know, as an American, very plain spoken, and tend to have strong opinions. And so I had to learn that kind of discourse as well, which was interesting.
It's kind of interesting that you were just advised to apply to Oxford, because I suppose even for many of us in Ireland, you know, you often think Oxford is for somebody else. And even when people achieve well, they don't put themselves in that bracket. And it's that disconnect between where you think you belong or not. But what was your research then, and where did that lead you?
Well, I had started studying Yeats with Declan Kybert at UCD. And
amazing Declan Kybert. He was my lecturer in UCD when I was just 17 and went into UCD. And he just was such a dynamic force when he lectured on Ulysses and Joyce. Changed my life about literature, I'd say, Declan.
Absolutely. He is such a talented thinker and teacher. So I remember Declan taping a letter of reference on his office door for me to collect and then post in with my application. Yes, he was incredibly supportive. So I had started studying Yeats with Declan Kybert, and I had been working for my MA dissertation on a thesis that looked at the Abbey Theatre in the centenary. So I was working the whole time I was in Dublin. So my first job when I arrived was front of house at the Abbey. And then there was an opening, a short-term replacement opening in the development office. So I moved kind of in the back of the administrative end of things. And of course, this is in the period of the theater's centenary celebration, which also coincided with major financial crisis at the Abbey. And so I was involved yes. in some of that development work to ensure the theater's long-term viability. But that context of being at the Abbey in the centenary got me thinking about the tension between financial necessity and artistic programming. So how you ensure that the work that you're doing is, you know, artistically interesting, is pushing boundaries, supporting contemporary writing, while ensuring that the money continues to come in, right? That the seats are filled by popular audiences who might not have an appetite for all of that kind of stuff. So I wrote my MA dissertation on that tension between the centenary programming and the financial campaign. So when I went to Oxford, I wanted to continue to think about that idea. So I started looking at the first government subsidy of the Abbey and the campaign for that subsidy and changes to artistic programming that were made around the time every year that the subsidy would be renewed, which was
incredible. Yeah,
it was really fun because, you know, I mean, I worked with Roy Foster, and Roy said this to me himself when I was like, you know, you're going to write about the Abbey, you know, is there anything new to say about the Abbey? And it turned out there was a lot of new things to say about the Abbey's history, because I got into the archive. I was working on director's minute books. I was the first person to have access to and be able to quote from minutes of the Abbey's board of directors, which discussed in detail changes that needed to be made to plays because of sensitivities of ministers in government, you know, whether or not the state could support plays that dealt with divorce, that dealt with unmarried pregnant women, and of all of these, and of the time, like avant-garde topics. Can the, you know, the nation with its ethos, like, fund a theater that is, quote, the national theater that is staging these kinds of controversial topics? So so that was the subject of my first book then, which came out in 2010, called W.B. Yeats, The Abbey Theatre, Censorship and the Irish State, where I looked at that history and dug up a lot of those behind-the-scenes conversations that happened in correspondence, either between Yeats and Gregory and government ministers, or between the theatre's directors, Yeats and others, about conversations that they had with government ministers, and also too looked at some of the intricacies around what plays were earning and what the government's financial position was and how it perceived risk in terms of funding the Abbey. So it was a really, really rich topic to work on.
You're now Professor of English Literature at Maynooth University, but that's relatively recent, Lauren, because I suppose when we first connected around the time of the Markovitch book, you were lecturing in Liverpool at Liverpool University, and I think you've been a fellow at Cambridge as well. So in your head, were you always thinking that it would be good to come and live here in Ireland and focus your research more fully in an Irish context?
There are a lot of advantages to working on Ireland and not being in Ireland, I think, because that outsider perspective is always, I think, a benefit.
Useful,
absolutely a benefit when you're working on an area. But the attraction to Maynooth was just overwhelming because of the dynamic direction that the university was taking. Like you say, that ability to be near archival material that I'll be working on probably for the rest of my career in some way, shape, or form, and not have to travel so far, you know, especially after having children, research trips become more difficult.
Because that is the other huge and massive change in your life in recent years, is that you have two beautiful young children, Noura and Sarah, I think.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, Noura will just turn 6, and Sarah will be 2 later this summer.
And tell me a little bit about that, because in some ways, by the time I saw you, you know, just before the pandemic, back living in Ireland, I was aware, I think, just by social media about your family emerging. I'm assuming that your partner is not Irish or English, but I don't really know a lot about that or him.
Yeah, so Ali's British. He was born and raised in East London. So he's not English, but he's British, which I think is an important distinction. He's born and raised a Londoner. Ireland was a big move for him. Absolutely. He wasn't sure he could ever, you know, as a Londoner, live anywhere other than London. But he has embraced it fully and loves it, especially the countryside. We spent most of lockdown in Dublin, and now we've just taken a lease on a farmhouse in kind of North Meath. So that's where we'll be living when we get back. And he's really excited about that. He's fully embraced the kind of agrarian lifestyle too, having spent a lot of time here in Florida, and happy between the extremes.
That sounds gorgeous. A farmhouse. So is there a sense in which coming to Ireland was also coming to terms with a country which is still getting its head round, you know, not being white?
Yeah. Ali is a Hashemite with a very long, you know, long family history that can trace back to the Prophet Muhammad. So there is a importance when we think about raising our family that they're raised with an awareness of that long tradition. And we were very concerned about bringing them to a place that is resistant in lots of ways to that hybridity of cultures. But that is changing too, I think, not just in Dublin, but across the country, a kind of openness to other ways of being and other ways of living. And that's very appealing to us. We were very concerned about the school system. So we're delighted that there are more education together schools now available that are not, you know, run by the church, because we did not want our children to have a religious education. We wanted them to have a fully secular education, and a hope that Ireland continues to move in that direction of the secularization of daily life, so that people like our family feel welcome and have equal opportunities.
Because we talked about Ireland changing from 2000, maybe when you first came as a young undergraduate to Trinity, and entering into a new world, which was also reflecting change culturally, ethnically, and in a sense, also seeing this great shift from a predominantly Catholic country to one which is far more secular now. And so you've seen and been around this gear change that's been happening in Ireland, but coming here and bringing your partner, your children here, you're also having to experience how we're maturing as a society and facing up to an intercultural present as well as a future. How have you found living in Ireland with your family?
It's hard to say, Helen, because it's been such a kind of crazy 2-year period for us. So it was easier with Nuera because she was 4 when we moved. You know, she had a lot of time in Liverpool, which is a very visibly diverse city, and in London, you know, near her paternal grandparents, as well as being able to spend time with my parents. So a really strong awareness of her roots as a person, which she, you know, she talks about and carries with her wherever she goes. Sarah was born the day that we landed in Dublin, the day that we moved. So all of her life so far has pretty much been in a tiny apartment in North Dublin. So I don't, you know, it's going to be different for her, and we have a lot of work to do, I think, to give her that same sense of her own family history, to give her a similar kind of base.
I suppose what's really lucky is that you're so close to London and her paternal family, and so in some ways, it was probably easier for your partner and for him to access his family compared to you.
Yeah, well, our view is that his family is my family and my family is his family, and we've had a long time together, so I've felt very supported by them, and it was amazing to, you know, be able to see them briefly when you know, restrictions lifted and his mother was able to come over for a few days and just have that. Just literally the touch that you miss when you're isolated from your family, because they're only able to articulate so much, and so much is communicated to them and by them through just, you know, a hug, just through like a cuddle on the couch, reading a story, that kind of experience that's impossible to replicate on Zoom or whatever. I have very strong memories of Nuera giving, you know, Nuera, who was 5 at the time, giving her my cell phone to WhatsApp my parents, and she had a little play tent in her room and would take the phone inside her play tent and talk to them. So she would have like, a private chat, a little bit of intimacy, and she would read stories to them, and my mom would read her books that were, you know, were mine, that are still in the house here. You know, a couple of times a week they would have that time together, which was a gift to be mentally strong during the lockdown, to kind of build some those muscles of the mind, you know, that you have to exercise to keep yourself in a good place in such difficult circumstances. And one way that I did that was through gratitude. And I know that is a word that is trotted out and is so, can be used so superficially, but any time that I started to feel sorry for us, I would think about the whole families that were living in one room and direct provision with no access to their families. And that was a real reality check for me.
It's a simple practice that maybe some of us probably ignored until these times when you started to have to think a little bit more, as you say, about that exercise of the mind and resilience around it as well.
Yeah, it's just like going to the gym, in my experience. You know, when you stop, you have to build those muscles back. And I think what has been so difficult is that, you know, it's been a marathon. It has been a long time. And, you know, there's also, I think, a lot of like cultural judgment around people who have, you know, who have succumbed to the pressure. And I think that it's also important to be mindful that that is not a weakness either.
All I was reading the Poets of Rapello. I mean, what's interesting, I suppose we're recording this today on July 8th, but July 8th, I think, is actually the release date for the Poets of Rapello, Lauren. Yeah,
that's right. It's today. It's today, the 8th.
So happy book launch.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's a beautiful cover and it's a great read because it has all human life in here. There is actually a lot of sex in it. The thing about it, like how Mussolini's Italy shaped British, Irish and US writers, at one level, it's that great sense of a moment where people came together. But I suppose for us here in Ireland, it really takes one of our icons, W.B. Yeats, your long-term subject of research, and again shines that light on a period and a relationship and a time, and allows us to think anew about him and particularly his later work, because, you know, it connects him so significantly and sharply to that period in the early 30s when there is the allure of fascism. And there was that sense in which so many people played with it and some people became fully converted to it. I mean, what was interesting for me, you know, as somebody, English lit degree, grown up here, and again, no more than Roy Foster was saying to you, is there anything new to say about the Abbey? You're thinking, is there anything new to say about W.B. Yeats? But his relationship with Ezra Pound is fascinating for me in this, and it also draws out the relationship of his wife, of his wife's relationship with Ezra Pound's wife, their kinship. And those things I hadn't really known or thought about as to, you know, what a significant influence Ezra Pound was and vice versa on Yeats. I mean, from your perspective, The Poets of Rapello is playing with the shadow of fascism and how those creative minds come together in this small place at a really significant time.
Yes, my starting point for the book was the relationship between Yeats and Pound. And initially, I thought it was going to be a book about their friendship in Italy and in the context of Italian fascism. And what surprised me was how wide their network and Rapello was, and in some ways how unproblematic being in Rapello was for, not just for Yeats. Obviously Pound went to Italy because he was attracted to the regime, interested in what Mussolini was doing, excited about opportunities for the arts in the new Italy as it was being conceived. Yeats arrived because of illness. So he was really, really ill, went to the south of France and then Spain and then landed in Italy so that he could be close to Pound, because George Yeats's, W.B. Yeats's
his wife.
Yeah. George was friends and cousins of Dorothy Pound, Ezra's wife. So she supported going to Rapello to be near Ezra and Dorothy. But what surprised me was how unproblematic being in Italy was for other writers who we think about as being bastions of democracy, particularly when we get to the mid-20th century.
You say right at the beginning that this idea of Yeats's fascism is something which has been talked about over many, many years and sometimes buried as a story. Obviously, Ezra Pound's relationship is very clear that he was incredibly attracted to fascism. I think I was taken aback by how close Yeats and Pound were, because, you know, Pound is at the wedding and then you have this relationship between the wives, and George, Yeats's wife, comes out much stronger in your book than perhaps I've ever seen her before. Was that something you wanted to do, was to see that human relationship of how people ended up doing something that in hindsight we can perhaps see in a very judgmental way, their attraction to fascism, but also see the human relationships that brought people together, that you have that sense of a very human story before politics.
I'm really interested in the idea of motivation, you know, what motivates people to behave as they do, you know, to think as they do, to have the politics that they have, in order not to just kind of judge them, which lots of, you know, critics do, historians do, you know, as a fascist or anti-fascist, you know, like, here are the white hats and here are the black hats. I'm really interested in getting behind that. So what are the motivating factors for their political thinking? How do they express those ideas through their writing in ways that aren't overt, you know? Because if you take the history of Rapallo simply from what was published by the writers themselves, you know, or the history of kind of collaboration as it's described by these writers in their published work, you get a very different story. It's also necessary to take this kind of behind the scenes approach in order to make these other lives visible. I am very interested in George Yates as a figure, in Dorothy Pound, and they would be completely invisible if you just go by the published work.
I mean, do you think we can read that as being part of what Yates is doing in his work and his thinking? You talk about in the book his bitterness with the Irish emerging state and with its form of nationalism, and in a sense with democracy. Can you give us a sense about what we learn about Yates in this, and how much further it takes us into understanding Yates's motivation in Rapallo, and also the insight it gives us into his thinking and politics as that aging statesman?
Yes, the research I've done shows how his fascination with Italian fascism is much longer than we've recognized up to now. That it just becomes different over time, less overt. So, you know, Mike Cronin, Roy Foster have written about Yates's interest in blue shirts, you know, Yates's remarks about Mussolini. This is all very, very early. You know, we're talking about 1924-ish. But we see through my research that fascination with fascism extending through Yates's time and Rapallo. It just takes another manifestation. So he's less interested in Mussolini as a leader once he, I think, is in Italy and sees Mussolini kind of on the ground and sees the way that Pound is deifying, in a way, Mussolini. And we see WB much more interested in aesthetic fascism. So how do you communicate these ideas about control, you know, of culture, the limits that are necessary, in his view, to be placed on democracy in order to ensure, in his mind, the preservation of what is good. And so we see him thinking about the possibility for public museums in Dublin that would give people an opportunity to access the past in a way that replicates the Italian regime's idea of living history and of moving among a resurrected Roman past that shows kind of the strength and grandeur of Italy. We see Yates wanting to replicate that in Dublin through reviving an 18th century past. And it's something that he writes about in work that he later revises. So it doesn't survive in the collected final publications that most people read. It's not in the work that he edits to be collected. It's not something that he wants to be as direct about when he reflects on his own career.
Do you think that in Ireland, the ways in which we have created not just Yates as icon, but definitely put him on the statue for obviously his body of work, that the area and the issue of him and fascism has been buried?
Buried in some quarters, I think, and in other quarters not. not overemphasized, but used to kind of dismiss him as basically a kind of silly old man. Whereas what we see in the research I've done is not that he's silly, not that it's any that his interest in fascism is a product of senility, but that it's actually a sustained interest that takes different forms through his career, if not fascism, then authoritarianism. And also that the reason that he reaches out so strongly to Italian fascism is because he is so anxious, and that anxiety for Yeats is a part of aging. It's because of, you know, the frailty of his health. He becomes more anxious about his legacy. He becomes more anxious about the legacy of the cultural institutions that he's been involved in. And having witnessed what he believes, what Yeats believes, this is not my view, but what Yeats believes to be a kind of chaotic revolution of this, a failed revolution of the Civil War that was intent on dismantling, right, all that was good that survived in Irish history. He is intent on seeking to preserve that and ensure that kind of instability never happens again, not only because of his belief in what the Irish state is, but also because of his mythology. So his ego is undoubtedly tied up with the preservation of this particular idea of Ireland.
In many ways, your book on Constance and Kazimir Markovitch creates that double window into a life we often see solely through the prism of Constance herself and her roots by seeing it in that fuller story of her and Kazimir. Within this, I mean, George, even with all the writing that's happened on Yeats, is still a less known character, and her influence is usually seen in quite a limited way on Yeats, his work, and his life choices.
You know, a lot of the reason for her lack of visibility and kind of popular ideas about Yeats is a book of her own choosing. And that's something that I talk about in Poets of Apollo, how both George Yeats and Dorothy Pound are happy to be in the background, and in a way sometimes pulling the strings, you know, being facilitators of the work, but not wanting to be in the public eye.
And in some ways for Yeats, the story, and perhaps in the public imagination, is always connected with Maud Gonne and Iseult, both as muses and love objects. And they often overshadow the real story of George herself. The footnote that was somewhat fascinating in the book was that Ezra Pound actually connects to Yeats over Iseult because he did have an affair with her before he married Dorothy, who is Yeats's wife's cousin. I mean, it all at times, this group and this network, it did often become quite incestuous with relationships and affairs.
When you read these poets, or when you study them, you know, as an undergraduate or whatever, you don't realize that they are fully rounded sexual human beings that have desires, that have messy relationships, that have kind of complex interrelations. And that's something that I really enjoyed unraveling. I think, you know, this satisfying W.B. Yeats' libido is something that George never wanted to be entirely responsible for. So she was really happy to facilitate his affairs, particularly late in life. It gave her a break. She understood that he needed things other than that she could provide, and she was quite happy for him to go and get those things, you know, with someone else. And it's incredibly modern frame of mind, and I think it's important to recognize how modern that thinking is and not see her as someone who was bitter or sneaked around. And she knew exactly what was happening, and she was quite happy for it to happen.
That definitely sings out of your book, Lauren, and well done on it. But where are the projects for you as you go into the next phase?
One that's at the forefront of my thinking right now is, you know, how important the 1930s is as a period to our moment, you know, the severe economic downturn, you know, that follows effectively global financial collapse, and the way that right-wing mindsets often feed off of
flourish.
That.
Flourish, yeah.
Absolutely. So I'm still thinking about the 30s. I'm thinking also about government support for the arts. I'm thinking about women visual artists in the 30s and government support through the New Deal. And so I'm working on a project that will bring to light some of the historically suppressed lives of the 30s that were instrumental to making New Deal art happen, but that have not been recognized in histories of the 30s that have been written, which mostly replicate the canonicity of 20th century art. So I'm thinking around that project.
So it's fascinating territory, Lauren, and lots to do as you go forward with it, either in the States or across Europe in the 30s. So, Lauren, thanks so much. Lovely to connect with you again. But enjoy Florida and being home with your family while you can. And obviously, we hope to see you back here in Ireland, if not at the farmhouse at Maynooth at some stage. Thanks a lot, Lauren.
Thanks, Helen. It's been great talking with you.